Look at the distortion in the air in front of you. See it fold and ripple, the way the light glistens off something that should not be there? Can you catch a glimpse of what is on the other side? It's called a wind door, and will take you to places both like and unlike our world. This one will take you to the 10 worlds of New Century, as written by Alex Shaw. Come with us on a journey through the wind door. Final Let Them Go episode. My original plan was to neatly divide this podcast into two parts, our discussion of the Gothic and our discussion of the mythological. And then the algorithm decided to throw a curveball at me. A YouTube video done for PBS by noted content creator Princess Weeks discussing the Byronic hero. I came into work, saw this recommended to me, and thought, sure, why not? It's something to listen to while I have my morning snack and read emails. It mostly covered stuff I already knew, although giving me far more modern examples of the Byronic hero that I might not have considered otherwise, such as Eric Killmonger from Black Panther, or Catra from the new She-Ra show on Netflix. And as I kept listening with one ear, a switch went off in my brain. Was Rebecca an example of the Byronic hero? I had to give it serious consideration given the text of the video, where it defines the Byronic hero as someone influenced by their trauma, something we can definitely relate back to Rebecca. The death of her little brother, the ostracism by her father, and the guilt she wrongly associated with her mother's stroke, these are all valid traumas which we have gone over in detail. More significantly are the words of Atara Stein, a professor of English at California State University, who has wrote extensively on the Byronic hero. When referring to certain classical female characters as Byronic heroes, she qualifies them as such because of their rebellion against a conventional society that stifles individuality, and goes on to add, these Byronic heroines take on the characteristics of the rebellious, ambitious, narcissistic, individualistic, and ultimately self-destructive Byronic male. Now, obviously, not all those words describe Rebecca. But there is enough truth in there that I had to ponder recontextualizing everything we'd already said about how Let Them Go fits into or subverts the Gothic narrative. Since this is not the last time we will discuss Gothic and the analysis of New Century, let me preface this conclusion with the words of Inigo Montoya. Let me explain. No, that is too much. Let me sum up. Rebecca has several of the earmarks of the Byronic hero, even though the story frames her to be highly sympathetic. Whether she would fall down the path of self-destruction, we will never know, because her path has been so thoroughly diverged by the Barghest and the old world that she was rebelling against will very soon be radically changed. But more importantly, the events in the story require her to let go of her collected pain just to survive, which is something that the Byronic hero seldom does. And if they do, they often don't do it alone, and Rebecca pretty much has to. Rebecca is both playing the archetype straight and then turning it completely on its head, and I appreciate each of these in turn. And on that note, let me take you back to the rest of our discussion already in progress, because these new revelations tie in very neatly with the context I now want to discuss the story from, the Divine Feminine. So, when we first started this look into Let Them Go, Toby, 65 million years ago... Okay, not really, but 5 to 6 weeks ago does feel like an eternity, especially now. I brought up the topic of the triple goddess. And there is an idea that I want to posit here in terms of how this plays into the evolution of the story. Because I was very excited when I first had this insight about Amanda, Rebecca, and Cleo inhabiting the three roles of that particular archetype, I immediately wrote a letter to Sharon asking about that and asking if this was just me coming up with an interesting pattern match here, or if there was some element of that which either she or Alex intended in the writing of it. And the very wise thing that she said is that everything that Alex does is intentional. I would further qualify that statement. While Alex always has intentionality behind the layers of meaning he puts into his stories, every now and then we do make connections that Alex wasn't cognitively channeling. Sometimes as a result of this very podcast, he noted that he was responding to a piece of media without realizing it, or that we made connections he hadn't intended. But it's also shocking just how we can make reference to exactly the right thing, or bring to mind something that he mentioned in a quick review he did years ago that we might never have heard. At least once recently he said, "Get out of my brain before you see all the spoilers for Phase 2!" One of the insights that she had into this is that Rebecca is meant to be all three aspects of the Triple Goddess. And that got my own brain working much later after the subject, that to a certain extent, the story of Let Them Go is about how these other women in her life are aspects of the goddess, but they are taken from her. So in order to become, in order to heal herself, in order to win the day, she has to incorporate those aspects into herself. The manifestation, the avatar of the crone and the maiden, as portrayed by Amanda and Cleo, have been killed in various ways. So she needs to both draw upon Cleo's wisdom and strength to go out and do what needs to be done. But she also needs to draw upon Amanda's intuition and willingness to treat the supernatural as real. Rebecca needs the strength of Amanda's imagination, creativity, and eventually compassion in order to finish her story. And in making all these things hers, it's a metaphorical transformation into the Triple Goddess, because that archetype already encapsulates the three in one. There is the singular aspect, and then there is the Trinity aspect. So the story is, I feel, like a form of apotheosis, of her not necessarily becoming a goddess per se, but symbolically, when her world has been, as we have said so many times over now, when her world has been torn from her, she has to rebuild something, and that includes rebuilding herself.
Exactly, and it's very much in the same way that the I was describing it as her becoming, like, finally being able to become the leader, the hero of her own story and path. And in your way of describing it, which I think is wonderful, is that Rebecca is becoming this goddess where she is finally able to create her own world, when in the past she had one part of the three but was incomplete in that sense. Control of her world was never in her hand, and now finally she's taken that control and is able to go out with that.
In addition to that, I will say that part of what makes me feel pretty spot on with this analysis as of her becoming all three aspects into herself is that it is only after all of this that much later in the story of New Century is she able to manifest some of the traits that are indicative of the Triple Goddess that she wouldn't have necessarily felt free to express otherwise. And I don't know if you know what I'm hinting at, but I think I'm going to leave it there for now, because that is spoiling something much further down the road in terms of Rebecca's story and her own growth as a person. But it will come up that there is something more of the mother in Rebecca that will finally have its day at another time in another story.
We're being so coy about so many things. Like.
Well, there is so much we can't talk about yet, because there is so much that new readers will not have known yet. So
they don't even know why we call this show Through the Wind Door yet.
No, that's something that will eventually be covered. Well, it's covered in both, I believe, Secret Rooms, which is what we're planning on doing next, but is also covered in The Cartographer's Handbook, which chronologically was the very first book that Alex wrote. It just so happens that the reason that I wanted to, when we finish up with this, the reason that I wanted to do Secret Rooms next, even though the storyline and the timeline of The Cartographer's Handbook and Secret Rooms, they overlap to a great deal. And there are things in Secret Rooms which are referenced but not said in detail because they're part of The Cartographer's Handbook. And there is stuff in The Cartographer's Handbook that draws upon elements that are more fully fleshed out in Secret Rooms. But I want to do it in that order because that was the order that I read it in. And I feel like once we start getting into New Century proper, while certain characters are very much the foundation of the new world that is being shaped by the cartographers and their leader, it probably does better to introduce to readers the two protagonists, which are going to be continuing throughout much of the story, well into the first book of Phase 2 of New Century. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's just my personal thought, but I think it works out well for the thing that we're trying to do here. Again, we've gotten off topic. The stuff with the Triple Goddess has brought us to the big moment here that I wanted to introduce as what this story overall means to me. And when I say that, one of the things that we've mentioned is there is a level of difficulty that comes with interaction with any fictional work between writer and fan. As we've been hitting our stride, I'm putting up more links that showcase some of the influences on a given discussion. And these days, that includes a lot of other internet content creators. One of those creators is Dan Olson of the Folding Ideas YouTube channel, and the video in question is called Annihilation and Decoding Metaphor. I'm introducing this one because it sort of highlights some of the stuff you were wanting to touch on earlier. You kept talking about, like, the ending of this movie explained. That this particular piece by Dan is very much poking at those kinds of videos put up on the internet and the importance of not trying to explain everything. Sometimes the metaphor is the important part, and not the, you know, how do we decipher this into a concrete reality that makes sense? Because sometimes the concrete reality isn't the point of the story. Fair warning before going into said video, it isn't talking in generalities. Dan is using the movie Annihilation as the specific medium to discuss the broader theme. So you might not want to watch it or even enjoy watching it if you haven't seen that film. The reason I feel this video is especially relevant is that even though the stories of New Century build a narrative that has to remain consistent from one story to the next, Let Them Go stands out from the pack. We've already discussed how Let Them Go was written in such a way that it could be a standalone story. It's unique in this regard, because while there is connective tissue, it has absolutely no larger plot significance except as related to our heroine, who will return. Mysteries in this book by and large stay mysteries, and that works well for the genre, but it also means that metaphor can have a larger sway. Annihilation has no sequels, no continuity, and minimal world building. Let Them Go borrows almost all of its world building from our extant reality, and the remaining bits and bobs from books that had already been written. You can remove it from the rest, and it stays internally consistent, which means that if one chooses, one can look at the story entirely from the perspective of metaphor, not unlike a parable or fable. One of the things that we've talked about along the way is that we are going to be taking different things from this ourselves. So when I mentioned that this meets a certain mythological criteria, this is my pattern matching that I'm doing here. The story that I'm about to bring up is one that has very specific resonance for me. Other people are going to identify with other parts of this story. They're going to respond more to the Barghest, or they're going to respond more to Dawson like I did. And whatever you, individual reader, take away from the story is equally valid. Unless you're a hate boy that has nothing but derision for stories that don't meet your worldview, and if so, why the hell are you listening to a fan podcast? One of the reasons why he stopped doing in-depth roundtables on all aspects of the stories that he did with the other voice actors is because he didn't want to step on anybody else's interpretations. He wanted to leave it up to people like you and me to be able to talk about this, and we want to be able to leave it up to you listeners to talk about the important things to you or the things that you see that we don't see. You know, whether you know more about gothic genre or you know more about supernatural genre, any of that, talk about it amongst yourselves. Bring it to us and we can talk about it as well. It's all important. It's all good. And any conversation lends itself to a better fandom and better interactions, better conversations, more thinking. You can overthink things, but in terms of literary stuff, in terms of understanding why a thing resonates with you or doesn't resonate with you, I don't feel like any of that is wasted. So don't ever feel, don't be like us and feel like our opinions don't matter, that, you know, really somebody else should speak because what do we know? That's just us self-deprecating ourselves because of personal anxiety or whatever. Honestly,
don't follow our lead. Believe in yourself. We believe in you.
Don't be like us.
It's not too late.
So one of my favorite mythologies goes back a long way. Like, the ones that people are the most familiar with are Greek mythology or Norse mythology, either because, you know, they're learning particularly focused on that, or maybe you just really like Thor because, you know, Thor in the comics, Neil Gaiman stories, or other stuff like that. Whatever it is, could be Egyptian, could be Japanese. Whatever your mythology, mine was, and I don't remember where this originally came from, but I think it was one of those things where I ended up digging deeper into certain favorite stories or comic books or such. Like, it's specifically Sumerian, like one of the very first societies and mythologies that were written down by anybody. People talk a lot about pre-civilization mythologies and strange iconic statuettes and stuff like that that we will never know the truth of because it was prior to any form of written language. Sumerian mythology is one of the ones that survived into this day. And the most important goddess of that particular mythology was Inanna. You may be more familiar with her Akkadian name Ishtar. And there was a strong likelihood that her cult influenced similar cultural mythologies, such as Isis in Egypt and Aphrodite in Greece. But thematically, she has more in common with Freya of Norse myth, because she was considered a goddess of both love and war, symbolizing the greater themes of both life and death. One of the more feminist aspects to learning about her was finding out that there was a lot of ancient poetry that talked about her, in which Inanna specifically waxed poetic about how beautiful her vaginal area looked, because she is the mother of all life, and also she is desirable by other men, other gods, and such like. This is really just scratching the surface, and while I say I'm a fan of her myths, I'm not a scholar, and it's not the point of the podcast, aside from the specific myths I plan to refer to. So if you're really interested in her, look her up on Wikipedia, and I'll put a link to the translated poem that I'm referring to in the show notes. So learning about her was a major aspect to growing certain parts of my, what I like to call my second feminist awakening. And in the process of learning about her, one of the big pieces of mythology about her is her trip into the underworld. There are many variations on this poem, but the essential inciting incident is Inanna is traveling there to meet with her sister Ereshkigal, who has dominion over the underworld like Hades of Greek myth. And they're sometimes like, oh, she's going in order to pay tribute to a fallen family member, or she goes there to confront Ereshkigal for being a threat to her power. However, she cannot enter the underworld with her godly might, either due to tradition or to avoid insult, or merely because of the nature of the underworld. She must divest herself of power in order to make that journey. When she comes and presents herself to Ereshkigal, for one reason or another, her sister strikes her down and hangs her quote-unquote corpse on a meat hook, you know, as proof of her power over her sister. Now, Inanna knew that something like this could happen if she went down there, so she set up arrangements prior to going there with her fellow gods or her handmaidens, and the way this is eventually solved is that spirits are sent to entreat with Ereshkigal in order to bring her back, and eventually this is managed, but Ereshkigal demands that somebody else be sent to take Inanna's place. And very often, as being part of the theme of the story, it tends to be her husband, because he did not tear at his chest and give proper deference to the fact that she was dead. He was just, you know, up in the castle living it up and ogling the other pretty girls or something like that. The purpose of this story is in general meant to highlight the reasons why the seasons change, much as the way Persephone's story is meant to do that in Greek mythology. And I think Isis trying to get back the body of her husband Osiris is meant to do in Egyptian mythology. So I've now said a whole lot about, because I needed to explain the elements of this story in so that you are familiar with it. I encourage people to go and read more about this themselves.
He's very good at this, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone. Greg will have the ability to just point you in directions that you did not know about, and you will then want to know more about it. So, yeah, I chose the right partner.
That is the hope. The thing I want to propose and, you know, discuss with you is Let Them Go a version of Rebecca traveling into the underworld? Based on my description just now, are there elements of the descent myth that seem comparable to Alex's story?
First of all, thank you again for that. That's a legend I was not familiar with, and it connects with a lot of these other ones, and that's always fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so I think, as the comparisons you made will kind of indicate, there is often a lot of comparison that can be drawn between the sort of classical templates that these myths present and a lot of modern texts and narratives. So I think it's a great jumping off point. I think you certainly see a descent with Rebecca, as I was talking about with the descent earlier with the supernatural, that things intensify as you go further along. And Alex makes a point of emphasizing just how tired Rebecca is, that she's starting to really just want that rest, and it just really makes the whole thing more and more nightmarish. So in the literal sense of a descent into hell, she certainly seems to go through that. In my research, from what I could understand, this sort of tale template, for lack of a better term, is quite a linear one. It's a journey down and then a journey back. And although Let Them Go isn't exactly a story with a lot of twists and turns, in the sense of we're not hopping to lots of different timelines or the like, it's not like the most recent Netflix Witcher series, which I haven't even finished that, but everything seems to be hopping around. In Let Them Go, it's very much a case of most of the main text, the events at Ravenwood and what transpires beforehand, is told in a very linear fashion, with two digressions to the past, and then at the end we have a sort of blending of time frames of us hearing the words of the letter while also seeing Rebecca venture outwards. So in that sense, it may not break up the linear fashion that I think these sorts of stories tend to go through, but I do think that it sort of questions it, or at least it represents enough of an intrusion that it does make me not necessarily doubt its status as being similar to one of these, but it does, in the same way that Alex not necessarily subverts for the sake of subverting, but merely sort of offers these counterpoints or challenges to some of these stories because they feel appropriate or they feel human and like more true to the sort of world that he sees things as or what he hopes things will be. And I think with Rebecca and her story, a lot of these stories culminate in a return from hell or the underworld, and the seasons kind of blends in well because there's a emphasis on nature in that final chapter, and that sort of works, that Rebecca is becoming one with the sort of seasons and landscape. But a lot of horrors tend to be just a descent without that pivotal return from the descent. They are just getting worse and worse and worse, and then the last character died, and what do we learn from that? And it's often, don't fuck with ghosts. Great. Very valuable. Glad you spent all that money to tell that important message to me. With this story, and I think what solidifies the connection and convinces me, is that there is that all-important return from the underworld. How that return often is that the heroine or the principal character is returning with some sort of person or artifact that is of paramount importance. And for Rebecca, even though her lemonade bottle cork, which was a memento from the magical day she spent with Rafe, is something she had beforehand, so it's not something new, but the Rebecca we had seen in the first half of the story seemed to be deliberately closing herself off from all mention and any idea of Rafe and her previous connection with him. And part of that may be to leave it as a surprise for us, but I think it is deliberately set up as Rebecca is taking steps to be not, like, spending more time than she needs to around Rafe. But to get back onto task, I would say that the shawl she takes from Cleo, the supplies, the shotgun, all of those are the sort of physical items that she is returning from the underworld with. And then, as we return to time and time again, for as much as Rebecca loses everything, she gains everything as well. It is often true that we are made in the worst of times, and this is kind of true of Rebecca as well. And so she really does go to the underworld and is confronted with the spirits of the underworld. You mentioned Persephone, and I am thinking of the, I'm blanking on the name of the Greek musician.
Morpheus,
thank you. He journeyed to the underworld and failed to return with what he sought. But the idea of going there and seeing the spirit of the person you so desperately want to be with, but kind of not fully seeing them, I think is very much like a part of that is twinned with the scene that Rebecca knows that if she lowers the covers, she would see these people. And it's very carefully written that it doesn't ever say that she does lower the covers and sees it. It's just she knows with the certainty of a child that if she were to lower the covers, this is what she would see. So it is happening, but it's also not happening. And it's in that sort of Schrodinger's cat thing that it is there and not there. And the moment that she will take the action, it will stop being the case. It will either be there or not be there. To make a long story short,
too late!
She goes to the darkest place and sees spirits of the people she loves, but manages to come out of that without losing herself to the underworld and the place that they inhabit too. And not only that, but she's able to come out of that into this world of life and nature. So she is not where things are dead. She is where things are very much alive, and she is able to bring something with her. So to answer your question, yeah, I think you're right.
Well, so there are other things that I'd like to highlight here. You picked up on some of the things that I'd actually forgotten about because it was right at the end, that when she goes into the woods to face Amanda, she is bringing all of these totems that are representative of Rafe and Amanda and Cleo with her in order to make this final confrontation. The aspect of traveling into the underworld, first of all, there's a reason why I brought up Inanna's in particular, not just because that's the one I'm most familiar with, but because there are different kinds of journeys into the underworld, and some of them are more intrinsically male, and some of them are more intrinsically female. To properly expound on that, let's first define our terms. Toby used the ideas of hell and the underworld both when he was trying to deconstruct the metaphor of a descent. It's important to specify that these two myths are different, that hell is not completely analogous to the various kinds of underworld. In the case of Ereshkigal, it is a shadow world that all go to upon death, and there is no punishment meted out to those that have died based on acts in life. The quality of existence there is more centered around proper burial. But it's still a place that does not have the same pleasures of the world of the living, so it can seem like a bad place to be. I'll add a link in the show notes for the interested. Toby also mentioned the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice as a descent into the underworld to retrieve a lost love, and there are many other stories that centers a male protagonist going there to complete a challenge or win a prize. Those stories are fine for what they are, but I don't put them in the same bracket due to those stories often framing women as objects rather than subjects. So let's discuss women-centric narrative. When I compared Inanna's descent to the myth of Persephone, due to it being an explanation for the turning of the seasons, those two stories have a very different feel to them. In the case of Persephone, she is kidnapped by Hades and needs to have her mother Demeter cause a drought on the mortal world in order to blackmail the other gods to convince Hades to give Persephone her freedom. Once more, even though the myth has her name on it, Persephone still feels like the thing acted upon rather than the actor. In Inanna's story, the journey is incited by her, and she sets up the mechanism for her own retrieval, even though doing so requires others to act on her behalf. She solved the problems she foresaw, and therefore saved herself. This is what began my comparison of Let Them Go to the Descent myth. While Rebecca's story doesn't start with the same intent, and as mentioned, takes years to fully come into pass, it's still a story where the things that make her strong are stripped away from her, including the people she cares about and the work she has made her own. She is brought to a point where she welcomes death, when spirits come to her and provoke her into action, donning proper raiment, and equipping the tools and totems that are the symbols of those she has lost, she regains not only her own agency, but symbolically, her life. But finally, we come to the confrontation of her and the Amanda Barghest, and once again we have the idea of two sisters in conflict. In the Descent myth, there were implications of Ereshkigal being jealous of her sister's power, or merely just that Inanna gets to be a part of the land of the living, where Ereshkigal is confined to the underworld. That conflict isn't the same in Let Them Go, not just because the Barghest is not Amanda for the purpose of the final confrontation. In the larger sense, it is Amanda that has the life she has always wanted, prior to everything that goes south. And had the Barghest not complicated things, she would gladly have given up parts of it in order to make Rebecca happy. So while some of the pieces are similar, the construction is very different. The overall metaphor of the Descent myth is also one of duality. Ereshkigal is not just Inanna's sister, she could be further qualified as Inanna's darker half. And even though my earlier dive into mythology was about a trinity, one can also see Rebecca and Amanda being opposites in various ways. On further consideration, one could even make the argument that Rebecca herself is not Inanna, but Ereshkigal, trapped in an underworld she cannot escape until Amanda, her vibrant sister, dies so that Rebecca can have life. This adds a poignancy to Rebecca's decision to not destroy the monster that Amanda has become. What kind of person would Rebecca be if she symbolically refused Amanda's gift by destroying what was left of her, both in body and in spirit? The final potential metaphor at play is the intent behind the original parable. Let Them Go also has a broader theme, but instead of the changing of the seasons, it is instead a symbol of the changing of the world we knew. Like, catastrophe has not completely befallen all civilization at this point. There are Barghest running rampant in Africa, one would presume, and that's part of the reason why the sequence of events that were set off happen as they do. But it is only just starting to come about in the UK and, of course, on the other side of the pond in America. This is very much like things are about to seriously hit the fan. As you'll find out, we don't really see the fall of civilization. We only really see, long after the fact, the struggling of the world to rebuild after so much has been lost there. To use a tired but also very apropos cliche, the end of Let Them Go is the end of everything. But it is also a beginning. For Rebecca and for the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that brings us to the end of our first book. We made
it. Yes, we made it. We survived. I would even say that analyzing this story in detail has been transformative for me as well. I have said over and over how both gothic and horror narratives are not easy for me to take in for different reasons, and even as I love this story to pieces, one of the things I said to Alex back when he brought us on for the interview is that I wasn't sure if I would ever be able to listen to the audiobook again, because it would hurt to do so. I don't feel that way anymore. I may have used this analogy in a previous episode, but it's still true. I have faced my ghosts like Rebecca has faced hers, and I am no longer afraid of this story and the emotions it brings out for me. And on top of that, it was a jumping-off point to start appreciating other similar stories, like Crimson Peak, without immediately having a negative impulse to avoid them. Well, I know that we've gotten a lot out of it, and we've got lots more to go, but goodness knows, maybe our words are helpful to other people that might have been feeling a certain way about the story or not necessarily known how to feel about the story, because there's a lot in there. But, you know, there's meat. There's something for everybody. A line that came up in a recent Lindsay Ellis video on the movie Titanic comes to mind. Even though Let Them Go is in part a tragedy, quote, "a well-told tragedy appeals to the human desire to hope." That's one of the best explanations I've heard for why Let Them Go works. All right. Well, yes, as Toby said, that is the end of Let Them Go. The next time we'll see you, we hope you have moved on to the next book in our series, which is Secret Rooms. To be specific, it is Secret Rooms, the Definitive Edition, because there is an old version out there, which I'm hoping that new readers won't be able to find at this point, because Alex has done his best to make sure that the newest version is the one that's available on all various sites where good audio dramas and books can be found. But it includes a whole lot more content, specifically chapters that were originally supposed to be in the final book of this phase one, Steamheart. He decided that Steamheart was going on too long, and so included a lot of backstory for our two protagonists of Secret Rooms, which makes it a stronger story in general. But since we're going to be talking about all of that additional content, it's important that whatever version you have includes all that additional content. In exactly 1 week from the release of this podcast, we will have hoped you have read chapters 1-5 of Secret Rooms, which also happens to encapsulate what is termed as part one, beginnings. So to all listeners that have enjoyed the ride thus far and are looking forward to more, we'll meet you all next time on a new trip through the wind door.
Farewell.
Just like last time, I wanted to include a properly enjoyable and thematic piece of music to close us out, and went through a couple potential choices. The one that won out is a song from the first album I ever owned by Sarah McLachlan, an artist that I especially loved during my 20s. You may be most familiar with her hit single Building a Mystery, which is very appropriate considering it's using the term mystery as it relates to both pagan and organized religions. But the song I chose is connected with a song on the album titled simply Fear. It was a song I sang a lot at karaoke because it vocalized the anxiety I fought through all through my 20s in regards to what I was going to make of my life. Now it is a direct reference to not just my fear, but Rebecca's fear as well. And the following track on the album I will play for you now is a direct response to that song, and emblematic of where we hope Rebecca is in the aftermath of her story. I give you Fumbling Towards Ecstasy.
Thank you.
and there is good stuff to be mined below the surface of what is, on the face of it, just a really well-tailed toll. Well-tailed toll. Well-tailed. I've been talking for too long. Otherwise, because now I'm tripping over basic words. That seems to happen when we get on the way we do.
Don't worry. That's completely normal, and I'm sure I'll do the same at one point during this codcast.
You did that on purpose.
You can't prove that. It is very much a case of the definitive edition kind of becoming what I think of when I think of secret rooms. So,
would you say it's definitive?
I would say it's very much definitive. It is the best. It is the best case of revisionist history. Depending on your own experience, definitive editions can mean a lot of different things. If you are familiar with Star Wars, for example, you may be fearful that we're going to have CGI, like, Sebulba creatures just walking across frame when a Barghest, like, shooting first or something like that. But
loved it when Abigail Gray said McClunky. No.
Who's Abigail Gray?
Okay.
We better close the window. We're letting too much info out.
That's all, folks.